PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to episode 21 of the PD Podscast, hosted by myself, Pranay Budhev. I'm really glad that people have been tuning into our last few episodes, and I hope you learned a lot from Mark Gaston and Miss Naomi Davis in our past two episodes. Now, to move to the other side of the world, I'm very, very grateful to be sitting with Dr. Alaric Arugis from Bombay, India. He's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, serves as the Vice President of the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of India, and has made huge steps in developing pathways for clubfoot, DDH, and cerebral palsy hip screening in the subcontinent. Dr. Arugis studied at the Seth GS Medical College and King Edward VII Hospital in Mumbai, followed by fellowships undertaken in the US and Singapore. He now has a very busy practice in Bombay, working with a phenomenal team, and is very active in education and training. Dr. Arugis, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Pranay. It's really an honor to be part of this podcast. I've heard a lot of good things about the PD Podcast. I've tuned into several of your episodes and I've really enjoyed it. So thank you once again.
Well, thank you so much. And it's nice to hear that our listenership has traveled borders as we'd hoped when we started this venture. The first thing I want to know is really, what is the typical journey of someone who wants to be a pediatric orthopedic surgeon in India? Obviously, there is very different training programs in the way it works.
Sure. So I think here the interest in pediatric orthopedics is just starting to evolve since the last few years. After we finish our training in orthopedic surgery, which is about 3 years, we then decide if we want to specialize in a certain specialty or we just want to continue as a general orthopedic surgeon. If you really want to specialize, there are very few centers in India, at least there were very few centers in India when I graduated out. And therefore, we had to look out west to look out for various other centers where we could sort of do our fellowships in. Nowadays, I'm happy to say that in India, we do have certain university accredited centers where you can do a pediatric orthopedic fellowship. There are about 5 or 6 in India so far. And that's something which has really happened in the last 10 or 15 years.
Obviously, a lot of our listeners, have heard of some of the orthopedic legends from India, like Dr. Ashok Johari, Dr. Benjamin Joseph, and they have been, a huge force in driving the subspecialty of pediatric orthopedics in India, setting up POSI in 1994, etc. You mentioned, obviously, you yourself went out to the Alfred DuPont Hospital out in the US. I'm sure you got to spend some time with Dr. McKenzie and Dr. Freeman out there. And you also went to Singapore. Tell us, what was your experience like in the US and Singapore? How long did you spend there? And what did you feel the benefits were in actually going out to some of the more Western countries to learn the subspecialty of pediatrics?
Sure, Pranay. After I finished my orthopedic residency and then I did a sort of a specialist registrar position at Wadia Hospital, that's when I really got interested in pediatric orthopedics. And as you mentioned, I was greatly influenced by my mentor, Professor Ashok Johari. He, along with Benjamin Joseph from Manipal University, were the ones who actually were the pioneers of pediatric orthopedics in India, having set up the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of India in 1994. After working a couple of years with him, I realized that I needed to enhance my spectrum of pediatric orthopedics. And hence, I applied for this fellowship at the National University Hospital in Singapore. And that was a great experience because I got to see something a bit different. I got to see an Asian perspective outside of India. The spectrum of disease was a little different because, as you well know, Singapore is quite a well-developed country now. And it was very beneficial for my first foray into pediatric orthopedics. Interestingly, I was very keen on doing a fellowship in the US, but as you can understand, it was quite hard at that time because there was very little information available to us on the internet about the various fellowships available abroad, and most of them required you to do the US MLE, which I didn't want to do because I was sure that I wanted to come back to India and practice and not settle down there. So interestingly, I did a small observership with Professor K. Wilkins in Texas, in San Antonio. And he was really the pioneer of pediatric orthopedic trauma, as you are well aware of. And I worked with him for about 6 weeks in an observership. And I casually mentioned to him that I had applied to the DuPont Hospital, but I had got no response from them yet. He just picked up the phone right away and spoke to Professor Jay Kumar, who was the director of pediatric orthopedic training in that hospital. And they called me for an interview right away. And within 3 months, I was offered this international fellowship at the DuPont Hospital in Wilmington, Delaware. And that was a great opportunity for me because I saw things that I had never seen before in India, because at that time, the US was well ahead of us by almost 10 or 15 years in various techniques and technologies in pediatric orthopedics. I remember I saw for the first time elastic nailing for forearm and femur fractures in children. I saw for the first time how complex pelvic osteotomy were performed. Richard Bowen was a very eminent pediatric orthopedic surgeon at the DuPont Hospital, and he really taught me how to perform complex pelvic osteotomies, especially the Stonus osteotomy, and later on the Gans periacetabular osteotomy, which came in later on. So I would say that the training in the US and in Singapore really opened up my eyes to the various different newer modalities of treatment of children, which we weren't so much exposed to in India at that point of time. So it was really an amazing experience. Thank you.
So tell me, obviously, following your fellowship, you came back to India, you've been working there for a number of years now. Where is your current job at the moment? And what does your clinical practice and the patients present to you actually entail? What kind of pathologies do you see the most of?
So the important things that we see in India are a lot of clubfoot. And when I was doing my specialist registrar training at the Wadia Hospital, we saw tons of clubfoot, not only the younger children who came to us as babies, but also the older ones who came to us after the walking age. And in the couple of years that I worked as a specialist registrar, we were operating almost 150 to 200 children with clubfeet at that time. And as you're well aware, in the 1990s, the posterior medial soft tissue release was the treatment of choice for clubfoot. And in fact, the acme of a good pediatric orthopedic surgeon was being able to do a fantastic soft tissue release. And we used to pride ourselves on spending 2 hours on dissecting those feet, separating all the little joints, releasing the tendons and ligaments, and getting a beautiful result at the end of surgery. When I did my fellowship at the DuPont Hospital, though this was the turn of the millennium, still at that point, the Ponseti method hadn't come into play for clubfoot treatment, despite having worked in one of the eminent pediatric orthopedic centers in North America. And it's only later when I got to interact with Ignacio Ponseti himself in 2002 that I was finally exposed to the Ponseti method of clubfoot treatment. So clubfoot has always been something that has been very close to me, that's something that I've really evolved the treatment of this condition. And that's something that I do even today. It's still been something that I've always been interested in. The other thing that's very common in India are hip dislocations, or DDH. And this is another thing where children come to us way after the walking age. Very few of them are diagnosed at birth because we do not have, till now, a screening program for DDH in India. And that's the reason why we find a number of children who come to us much later on when they come in with a limp or with a limb line discrepancy. A third part of my practice, of course, is with cerebral palsy. And as you're well aware, cerebral palsy is really increasing in incidence all over the world, as more and more babies are now being saved, and a lot of babies who are premature now get extremely good neonatal care, especially in big cities in India. And cerebral palsy is another important part of our practice in pediatric orthopedics. Besides this, of course, we deal with also complex pediatric trauma. We get referrals from general orthopedic surgeons to manage complex elbow injuries, to manage fractures which have been neglected over time. And of course, a final part of our practice, of course, deals with infection, because we do see a lot of infections, acute and chronic septic arthritis and osteomyelitis. And finally, the last is deformities that are present in children, congenital and developmental ones, because we see a lot of children with nutritional rickets who come to us with varying degrees of severe deformities involving the lower limbs. So that's really the spectrum of pediatric orthopedic work in India.
So pretty much absolutely everything. It must be very, very busy out there. But what you've done there is you've touched on very well in your top two or three things that you mentioned, that where you have really focused your efforts on in helping improve pathways, treatment pathways, not only just for your hospital and your own practice, but for the whole of India. In fact, I followed you on Twitter quite early, and you can find Dr. Arugis at Arugis on Twitter. And in his bio, he writes, on a mission to end disability clause by Clubfoot and DDH. And knowing you more and more now, I can see how you really focus so much effort in those two areas. Tell me, once you'd met Dr. Ponseti in 2002, how did you translate and adopt practicing the Ponseti method? And how have you begun sort of improving training and awareness of this around India?
That's a very interesting question. And the journey that I've had in Clubfoot over the last 20 years has been really interesting. We were initially very strong skeptics of this method because, as I told you before, surgery was fun. We enjoyed doing these very extensive and elaborate surgeries for Clubfoot. And when we heard about the Ponseti method in the late 90s, we kept feeling that that's a different spectrum of cases that people were dealing with in North America. They were the milder forms. They were not the severe kind of sloppy we saw in India. And it's only when I met him by chance at the third International Clubfoot Congress, which was held concurrently with CCOT in San Diego in 2002, where I actually saw the kind of work and the cases that he had. And I wouldn't say I became an instant believer. It took some time to get convinced, but it shook me enough to say that here's a method which is working in someone's hand, someone who has been using it for the last 50 years or so, who's published reams of work on it, and yet there is not enough uptake of this method around the world. So I came back from that meeting very enthused to say, let's try this out in our institution. And I would say within a span of a year, from operating 150 to 200 clubfoot cases by surgery, we very gradually started drifting towards the Ponseti method, so that over a period of a couple of years, whereas 90% of children were undergoing surgery previously, we were now treating these children conservatively with the Ponseti method. But the real fillip to the entire process came about with a visit by Shafiq Pirani to India. Shafiq, as you know, is a Gujarati Indian who immigrated to the UK and then on to Canada, and who did some exemplary work in setting up the Uganda Sustainable Clubfoot Project in somewhere around the late 90s. And he came down to India in 2003 and had a little meeting with some of us young pediatric orthopedic surgeons, and I say young then, and convinced us that this was a method that was here to stay. He was so enthused by this entire project and told us how he had amazing success in teaching medical officers in Uganda about this technique. And he said, there's no reason why skilled pediatric orthopedic surgeons that we have in India could not adopt the same process. And we had the first Ponseti training in India in 2003, led by Shafiq Pirani. And from that moment, we haven't looked back. Ever since then, this entire method has spread all over the country. And I'm happy to say that I've had some role in popularizing this method among the pediatric orthopedic surgeons in this country. When we established this method in 2003 across India, we were very happy with the initial results. But then, like all things, we needed to audit our results at the end of about 4 or 5 years. And while we found that more than 90% of our children were doing really well with this method, when we looked at our follow-ups, we were horrified to find that we had a very dismal follow-up rate of less than 30%. And we know that the Ponseti method is a very labor-intensive treatment. It has a very short period of correction, which is very easy to do, but has this long maintenance phase where you need to follow up these children for at least 4 to 5 years to prevent relapses and recurrences, treat them with braces and provide them with the braces. And we found that we didn't have the capacity to do that in India. And then very fortuitously, we came in contact with some NGOs which had established these programs in Africa, namely Cure Clubfoot Worldwide, which was a well-established NGO at that time, run out of the United States, but having great programs in sub-Saharan Africa. And we decided to liaise with them for service delivery, asking them to help us out in a few things. And what we asked them to do is to help us with training orthopedic surgeons in the Ponseti method, because there was no standardized curriculum at that point, to help us out with the procurement of braces, because we didn't have access to good quality, low cost braces, which are integral to the Ponseti method. We didn't have counselors to guide the parents and create awareness about this technique, because as you're aware, treating so many children in the clinic, the orthopedic surgeons really don't have the time or the inclination to sit with the parents and counsel them over the importance of follow-up, the importance of bracing. And that's where we liaised with these NGOs, and I'll name a few of them who really helped us in this initial phase. So Cure Clubfoot Worldwide was one. Then we had Miracle Feet, we had Rotary, we had CBM and ICRC, who all came on board and helped to develop a consortium to set up a national clubfoot training program in India. And we realized that India is such a huge country, rather than going from top down, we decided to do a bottom-up approach, where we said that since health is a state subject, rather than going to the central government, let's liaise with state governments and help to set up clubfoot clinics in various district and university teaching hospitals in various states of India. And going state by state, we helped to establish these clinics in various district hospitals. We trained the orthopedic surgeons to understand the Ponseti method. We had a very rigorous two-day training course, which had theory, which had hands-on practical training on clubfoot models and on children, following a very standardized curriculum, which we didn't have before. And that really changed the treatment of clubfoot over the last 10, 15 years in India. And I'm happy to have been a part of that process. So this is all that we did with liaising with these various non-governmental organizations in setting up this national clubfoot program. And I'm happy to say that at the last count, we have almost 75,000 children who have been enrolled in this national program. We have data which is there at state level. Several centers have their data uploaded onto the Ponseti International Clubfoot Registry, which is housed in Iowa. And from there, we have a very huge and rich database that we can then work on to develop various studies related to clubfoot.
Yes, and you know, I've been fortunate enough to read some of your studies, and two of them I'd like to discuss actually. So they're both two of your recent ones. One has been talking about the Ponseti method after walking age. Tell us the results of that study that you looked into.
So that was something that was really interesting to us, and we waited for several years to get the data on this. As you're aware, when we first began the Ponseti method, we followed Ponseti's principles of doing it for the younger child, and we were still doing surgeries for the older children who came to us, because we did not believe that the Ponseti method would work in these older children, for the simple reason there was no data on them. And I remember at the first clubfoot meeting that we had in Ponseti's honor in 2007 in Iowa, where we had Ponseti experts coming in from all across the world, I remember going up to Ignacio Ponseti and asking him, what is the oldest age you think that this method would work, that your method would work? And he said, honestly, I do not know. The oldest child we treat in the US is about 6 months of age. You're the ones who will be treating these older children and giving us the answer in a few years to come. And that really enthused me to collect data, came back home, started working with these older children, began with children between the ages of 6 months to 1 year, and then finding good results, we gradually then went to over increasing the age limit to 2 years, to 5, to even 10 years of age. And when we had sufficient data over the last 10 years, we decided to look up all our results and publish this. And we came out with two publications. One was just the data from our own institute, where we had about 56 children between the ages of 1 and 10. And we showed that using the traditional Ponseti method works extremely well, even at this age group. We didn't modify the process in any way at all. We used the same traditional Ponseti principles. The only difference is that after a tenotomy, we found that many of these children would not correct with a single cast. And some of them needed serial plasters, two or three of them, to give further dorsiflexion after tenotomy. But we were so enthused by the results that we have started expanding this now to even older children. Of course, we did find that in this older age group, the risk of relapse is much higher than the younger ones. And we found in our study about a 30% relapse rate. But the good thing was that as Ponseti showed, even with the younger children, these relapses are flexible. They are amenable to recasting and tenotomy. And they all land up with a good result, at least in the short term. Of course, we don't have long-term data still, but the initial results of around 5 years follow-up showed us that it was a really good technique. And then I was contacted by some colleagues from South America, whom I knew well from previous conferences of Ponseti experts. And they said, why not let's do a multi-centric study? And we got together 15 centers in 7 countries. And we published this study of around 300 children between the ages, again, of 1 to 10. And this, I think, is one of the largest series of older children that was published in the Iowa Journal of Orthopedics last year. And that, again, showed very similar results, that we had 87% correction rate with a relapse rate of about 30%. So it has been shown quite consistently now by various papers coming out from especially Asia and Africa that this method works extremely well. The one thing I would say is that we avoid using the term neglected, because I find that's a pejorative term. It indicates that parents are willfully neglecting their children, whereas in true effect, it's because of lack of accessibility to good healthcare and the systemic inequities that are present in our healthcare system. And therefore, we prefer to use the term either walking age clubfoot or delayed presenting clubfoot, which really explains the problem rather better than using the word neglected. Thank you.
Yes, I completely agree. And that's absolutely amazing, because it really only is in countries, I guess, where there is that issue with accessibility, where you would be presented with this older population with, as you sort of said, walking age or delayed presentation of clubfoot, to allow you to then practice Ponseti's method and assess its outcomes. And obviously, you know, the multi-center study that was published last year is a real testament to collaboration and the fact that the principles that Ponseti originally described, you know, remain true. The other paper I wanted to ask you about is the more difficult type, the non-idiopathic clubfoot, the sort of neuromuscular or syndromic patients that we tend to see. You know, being in the UK, we'll only really see a handful of them, and they may be in some very specialist centres. But I know you published a paper on that cohort of patients as well. Tell me a bit about that.
Yes, we did. And that's the good thing of working in an institution where you have multidisciplinary care available. And we immediately realized when we were treating clubfoot that about 15% of our children had various syndromes or had a neurogenic cause for clubfoot. And these are children who traditionally were treated with very extensive surgeries. In fact, 20 years ago, we published our paper showing the role of telectomies in these neglected clubfeet, especially in arthrogryposis. And we showed that though you can get a plantigrade foot, over the long term, these children were painful and they weren't really happy. And several other authors have shown the same. And just as we were treating older children with clubfoot now, we said, let's try using this in the syndromic ones as well, or the non-idiopathic clubfeet. And then we gathered up our data over the last 10 years and we published about 89 patients with various different syndromes and etiologies. The biggest group, of course, which was arthrogryposis, which is a very difficult condition where you have multiple contractures of various joints and typically very resistant to conservative treatment. But here again, we found that if you use Ponseti principles in a gentle manner, we were able to get correction again in about 87% of these children. Though again, the relapses were about 40% in this group. The good news again is that many of these were flexible. They were amenable to recasting and tenotomy. And though they were not as successfully treated as the idiopathic group, they were much better off than the ones who had undergone these very radical soft tissue or bony surgeries, at least in the medium term. So we are quite enthused to use this method now, even in the non-idiopathic clubfeet. There are several other studies from around the world which have shown the same. Some have described some modifications to the technique, for example, doing an early Achilles tenotomy because of severe equinus. We haven't had the need to do that yet, but I've kept an open mind that in certain cases, we must understand that some modifications to Ponseti principles might be required. This does not mean that surgery does not have a role to play. I think in today's day and age, we must be practical. The Ponseti method is not a panacea for all types of clubfeet and for all degrees of severity. There are certain clubfeet which will resist the conservative treatment, and we must be open to the fact that surgery does have a role even now, though it has a very limited role as compared to what it was 20 years ago.
I think, you know, these sorts of studies, as you mentioned, have such a huge impact. And, you know, what we'll do is we'll attach in the show notes these two papers for the listeners to have a look at themselves and see if they could potentially start adopting it in their practice or at least share it with their colleagues. Because it's so interesting as to how such phenomenal research is coming out. And that's largely, I guess, because of the large numbers that you have there out in India. Obviously, I know you're part of the Global Club for Initiative. You serve on the Medical Advisory Board. In your opinion, where do you feel clubfoot treatment and management and even understanding of cause is going to develop in the future? What do you think there'll be with regards to use of technology? And also maybe, I know there's been some work being looked at with regards to developing a sort of universal clinical outcome score.
I think the future of clubfoot treatment lies a lot in technology now. You know, the way globalization has worked and the world becoming flat, we can now connect with people from all over the world and share experiences. And this has been one of the strengths of the Global Clubfoot Initiative. It's a consortium of about 30 different non-governmental organizations which provide clubfoot care, both training and service delivery, in various parts of the world, especially low-middle-income countries. And that's great because 80% of clubfoot children are born in these countries. Almost 200,000 children born with clubfoot every year. 80 to 90% are born in low-middle-income countries. And that's where the bulk of treatment should lie. And that's what GCI has done by bringing together various players who have worked together in training and providing treatment for clubfoot. One very interesting project that I've been working on for the last few years is the role of technology, e-learning and developing mobile health technology to help in the training of practitioners with the Ponseti method. And thanks to the COVID pandemic, we have seen the importance of online training. We got onto this many years even before the COVID pandemic. We liaised with Orthopediatrics, which is related to Boston, and we developed an online resources of developing a training standardized curriculum for the Ponseti method. We also liaised with a company from Spain, which was very good with developing animations, and we developed one of the world's first 3D clubfoot models, which was very helpful in training young surgeons and young practitioners on the Ponseti method. So, leaving the fact that in-person trainings are now becoming difficult, if you go online and learn some of the techniques, it's a valuable addition to your training armamentarium. And that's where I feel trainings really should be heading towards in the next few years. We also realized very quickly that another important aspect of clubfoot treatment is the role of braces. And adherence to bracing or lack of it is one of the biggest problems that we face nowadays with the Ponseti method. And we came up with this concept many years ago of whether it be possible to incorporate sensors within the foot abduction brace to help us to understand whether the parents were actually using the brace as per the recommended hours. And this was because, of course, work done before on scoliosis, where they have used sensors within braces, temperature sensors, to find out that the children were actually using the braces. And we decided to liaise with the Indian Institute of Technology, some very brainy people, who are into biomedical engineering. And we decided to develop sort of indigenous sensors which could be incorporated into our clubfoot braces, which would tell us whether the child is wearing the brace or not. We began with various iterations. We started with a pressure sensor and then went on to a temperature sensor and finally a touch sensor. And then realized that it's not enough to just have that information which can be put onto an SD card, which then the patient has to bring with him every time they come to follow up in the clinic. But if we can transfer or transmit this information remotely using Bluetooth and the cloud technology, the doctor sitting in the clinic can have a daily access to the brace used by the patient. We got a grant from CCOT, which was a very modest grant, but helped us to liaise with the Institute of Technology to actually develop a prototype of a brace, which we called a smart brace, which had sensors incorporated within it, and also a Bluetooth module to transmit this information to the administrator or the healthcare professional sitting in the clinic. And while it's only a prototype for now, it's very easy to transfer this knowledge from bench to bedside. And I envisage in the next few years, that's where clockwork treatment will be headed, to leverage the use of technology in enhancing the treatment we provide to children with clockwork. Another good study that we have been working on for some years, and I'm glad that several of our friends from the UK have taken the lead in this, is to develop a core outcome set to report outcomes of clubfoot treatment, because we still don't have, as of now, a very good measure of how do you determine success of clubfoot treatment. There are so many different scores and scales available, but not one of them has really been thoroughly validated for its use in clubfoot, which is contextually applicable to various different types of cultures. And that's another part of research that we are into now, to determining some of these core outcome sets that will help us to determine how do we report the outcomes of treatment of clubfoot.
I mean, that's so much work you've been doing and you're involved in. I'm surprised you have time for anything else. But we're going to move on to the incredible work you have done with the other problem with late presentation, and that's obviously DDH. I know you've been involved in essentially helping set up and leading the development of DDH screening guidelines in India. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that this is no small feat when it comes to a country which has a 1.3 billion population. It involved liaising with seven national associations and 120,000 medical personnel. Tell me, how do you make that happening? And what is your goal with regards to screening in India at present?
You know, besides clubfoot, the other thing, as I mentioned earlier to you, that we see a lot of is late presenting DDH. And many of these children then require very extensive reconstructive procedures. And when we spoke with our pediatric colleagues, we realized that many of them did not see DDH. And when we talked to them, they said that DDH is something we see once in a lifetime. And we said, there's this big disconnect that's happening here. We as pediatric orthopedic surgeons are seeing a huge number of children coming to us after the walking age, where obviously conservative treatment will not be so useful. And on the other hand, we have our top pediatricians telling us that they do not see much of DDH. So obviously there's a big gap in screening. And we've run into this problem for several years, but it's only now that the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of India decided to take that leap of actually liaising with these different organizations to develop screening guidelines for India. We are quite late in this. We know that several countries in the West have already done this. There are several countries in Europe which have a very systematic screening protocol for DDH right from birth till the first year of life. And we just don't have this in India. And I think one of the biggest problems for this, or the reasons for this, is because we have a very fragmented healthcare system. We have a sort of a dichotomous healthcare system where we have the public healthcare system provided by the government, which provides very basic care, but it's not the best. And then, of course, we have the private healthcare sector, which takes care of almost half the population of India. And there again, there are very few protocols or algorithms in place for screening. So when we decided to take up this project, we said that unlike clubfoot, which would work from the bottom up, here we need to work quickly. We need to work from the top down, liaise with the top national organizations which deal with children, and they predominantly are the Indian Academy of Pediatrics, the Neonatology Forum, the Federation of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who are the main people who are dealing with young babies. And we began this four-phase process, which lasted over a year, a good part of the year. And I must say, thanks to the COVID pandemic, all of us were stuck at home. And very fortuitously, this helped us to develop these training modules and liaisons with these various organizations. So what we began is a four-phase approach. The first phase of creating awareness among our pediatric colleagues and primary care physicians, because they just would not accept the fact that DDH is a problem in India. So we first began by presenting studies from India, which showed that the incidence of DDH was as much, if not more, than what we see in the West. But they were just not being picked up. The next step was to generate the evidence. So we brought up all the different articles of literature and spent almost 3 months going through the various literature, showing the pediatricians and the people on the expert panel that DDH is a problem which requires to be screened. And therefore, we formed an expert group of around 20 important people from these various organizations, who then established a third phase of developing a consensus, because we found that after taking the various guidelines published from across the world, we must be able to adapt that to the Indian healthcare system. And we know, because of our dichotomous and fragmented healthcare system, we need to have something which works both in the public as well as the private healthcare sector. And we immediately latched on to the fact that the immunization schedule in India is extremely well run. That's something that India has been doing well for several decades now. And almost 90% of children born in India access good vaccination and good immunization. So we realized that if we have to have DDH screening set up in India, we must emphasize the fact that it's not only a one-time diagnosis at birth, but we must have this periodic surveillance every time the child comes in for their immunization or their vaccine shots. And that's what we developed through this consensus, to understand that, make it a process where every time the child comes in for a vaccine, the pediatrician or the neonatologist or the healthcare professional spends a minute to check the hips. And the focus therefore would be on physical examination as the key for universal screening, and then do selective imaging for children who are high risk. We know that ultrasound is not easily accessible or available in India. We have a very strict law against use of ultrasound because of the gender disparity in India. So we have something called the PCPNDT Act, which is the Preconception Prenatal Act, which restricts the use of ultrasound and does not allow us to use point of care ultrasound anywhere. And therefore, a very useful modality which would help us to screen DDH really easily is unfortunately not available in India because of legislation. And therefore, we have to think out of the box and say that if ultrasound is not available to us universally, we must use it very judiciously as a screening tool only in high-risk cases. X-rays are easily available all across India. And if you have no access to an ultrasound in the first few weeks of the child's life, we would recommend getting an X-ray done at 4 months of age for every child who is high-risk or who has a suspicious or evidence of DDH clinically. So that's where we are with our DDH guidelines. And having developed those guidelines now, we are on to the phase of implementation, where we'll be publishing this soon, and then spreading this across all across India through various teaching modalities with the help of brochures, flyers, webinars, conferences, and various other knowledge translation devices. In this aspect, I really must thank the efforts of my friend Kishore Mulpuri from Canada, who is the head of orthopedics at the University of British Columbia. He's also a very staunch supporter of FOSI, or the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of India, and who very generously allowed us to utilize his research database that they have in setting up some of these guidelines. He, in fact, helped us to appoint a research coordinator paid by the University of British Columbia. He helped us to utilize the REDCap facility that they have to conduct various surveys and our various webinars. And none of this would have been possible without the help which came to us from the BC Children's Hospital. So I really must acknowledge his role, not only in this project, but even in the subsequent one, which is the one on hip surveillance for children with cerebral palsy.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Mulpuri there. He's also recently been appointed as the president of the Canadian Orthopaedic Association, and hopefully we'll be having him as a guest on the PD podcast in the future. And he obviously helps run the International Hip Dysplasia Registry database, in addition to launching earlier this year the Hip Hope Network, which is this growing global network of hip health professionals committed to improving the care clinically, through research, education, and training. And I know that the whole DDH program essentially is them trying to help improve international hip health through country-specific algorithms. But you've done an amazing thing in coordinating and collaborating with all these other medical personnel, obviously through a very strict four-step protocol, as you've just mentioned there. And I really hope that, you know, it has its impact, and I'm sure it will. I'm not sure if you know, there was a paper published from the UK in 2019 showing that despite having selective ultrasound surveillance for hip dysplasia, we had no difference in the number of late presenting cases of DDH still arriving on our doorstep, which is why I, including some others, are still staunch advocates for universal ultrasound screening where possible, of course. You mentioned there, obviously, your other project that you're doing with Dr. Mulpuri Support, which is tackling CP hip surveillance. And I know you heard our recent episode with Mark Gaston talking about CPIPs and obviously CPUP, which was started off in Sweden. Tell me about how you are developing this surveillance guideline now.
Yes, thanks, Pranay. You know, having developed the DDH guidelines, I think the next logical step would be was then to work on CP hip surveillance. And we know for several years, thanks to the wonderful work that CPUP has done in Sweden, and then being really stimulated by what you all have done in the UK, we have been following with great interest CPIP and its evolution, how it began first in Scotland and then spread all across the country. And I've been a great fan of seeing how you all got together a team of people who are very committed to the cause in developing guidelines, not just for hip surveillance or hip screening in CP, but almost developing an integrated pathway for all of cerebral palsy. And correspondingly, what we did is to again work with some of these important national organizations. So again, we took the help of this time the Indian Academy of Cerebral Palsy, which is a flagship organization, which is multidisciplinary, has on its board professionals from various different specialties, orthopedics, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, pediatric neurology, physiatry. And we got together again an expert group of professionals to form a national committee to develop guidelines for hip surveillance in cerebral palsy. And as you're aware, that's a very important problem. We know that almost 30% of children with cerebral palsy will develop hip displacement somewhere in their lifetime. And of course, this risk is much higher in children who are not walking, what we call the GMFCS level 5, who have almost a 90% incidence of hip displacement. And again, the main thing that we had to face here was awareness from the various specialists. While orthopedic surgeons were well aware of the importance of hip screening, several of the physiotherapists and pediatric neurologists and physiatrists were just not aware that hip displacement is a problem in children with CP. While they were treating various gait abnormalities, they were big users of botulinum, bracing, and various other soft tissue surgeries, very few of them were aware of the fact that the hip needs to be looked into in CP. And this is despite the fact that Sweden, Australia, and a few other countries have already established these beautiful guidelines more than 10, 15, or even 20 years ago. So we are well behind the curve. And despite that, the awareness in India was very low for this condition. So once again, we decided using the good offices of FOSI in leadership, we again decided to liaise, as I mentioned, with these national organizations, predominantly the Indian Academy of Cerebral Palsy, the Association of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, the Physiotherapists and the Occupational Therapy Association, and of course, having the pediatricians and the orthopedic surgeons also as part of it. And again, we use the same principles that we use for developing the DDH guidelines. Step one of creating awareness among all the different stakeholders. We went through a 3-month phase where we reviewed the literature extensively, looking at the existing surveillance programs and the need for surveillance in children with CP. We then developed again the Delphi approach to develop a consensus among the various stakeholders, deciding what tests we would be using, who would do the screening, and when we would screen these children to develop an algorithm for screening of hip in cerebral palsy. And once again, we are in the phase now of having written up the guidelines to publish it and then to look forward to its implementation. And I know that both these projects are not sprints, they are marathons. We are going to take many years to see the results of this, but at least I would feel it's the first step that we've achieved for the first time in India of developing guidelines which would help healthcare workers and professionals to understand the importance of screening both for DDH and for cerebral palsy. Again, yeah, I would like to acknowledge the leadership shown by our mentor, that's Dr. Ashok Johari, who really led the CP HIP project, and the immense amount of encouragement and support we received from the leadership of FOSI, especially its president, Dhiren Ganjwala, and the secretary, Sandeep Patwardhan. So these are projects that have been led by FOSI. We are a really small organization. We are barely about 650 to 700 members, but we punch much higher than our weight. And we manage to liaise with these huge organizations who have memberships of around 40 to 50,000 professionals in their membership. And I think this collaboration that we have developed is not only going to help us in the short term, but even in the long term of several other projects which require collaborative efforts with other organizations beyond orthopedics.
It's absolutely incredible what you have managed to achieve, especially over the COVID pandemic, as I know a lot of this has happened in a relatively short period of time. And it seems like virtual working and meeting has suited you very, very well when it's come to this. Another area that I know you have really harnessed when it's come to the use of virtual platforms, it has been in training. And your hospital, the Wadia Hospital for Children, was granted the JBJS Rommel Buchholz Journal Club grant this year, which is one of the first time the awardees has been outside North America and is used to help support journal activities. What you have done out there with POSI has been incredible, setting up Meet the Authors type sessions, essentially a journal club with the most legendary leaders, stalwarts of our field. Tell me, how did you come up with the idea of making it so democratized so everyone could tune in? And where can our listeners find out about any of the future webinars and virtual journal club meetings you are organizing? Because I certainly have had a huge interest and really learned a lot from attending them virtually.
Thanks, Pranay. In fact, I would say that I have to thank social media, in fact, for finding out about this grant. It was on Twitter that I realized that on the JBGS site, they mentioned about the fact that we have this grant, which is available now. It's a modest amount, but it really helps us to set up a journal club and reach more people. And the purpose behind this, the Robert Buchholz Journal Club grant from JBGS, was to basically help a certain institution to train its fellows to maybe set up some infrastructure as well to help in the purchase of some journals, be it online or physical. And when we received this grant, and we were pleasantly surprised to find out that we were the first time an institution out of North America had received this very prestigious grant, then we realized that why just keep it to ourselves? Why not allow knowledge to be spread? And that's something I've always believed in, that knowledge is something that should not be kept to ourselves, but should be spread around to everyone else. And I realized this many years ago when I struggled initially to achieve a fellowship position somewhere. And there were such few opportunities available to us. We didn't have the information, we didn't know where to go. And hence, during my position as the secretary of FOSI and then subsequently as the vice president, has always been my endeavor to create training opportunities for our younger surgeons. And besides this journal club that we then decided to open up to all FOSI members in the form of a Meet the Authors Club, where we actually invite stalwarts in pediatric orthopedics who have published their work in JBGS to actually present that work much beyond what the article tells us, to share with us little nuggets of information, which are sometimes difficult to tease out from just reading that publication. And I must say that we've had four episodes so far. We have learned a lot from several of these stalwarts. They've shared with us the struggles, the difficulties in doing these studies. They've shared with us little points of information and take-home messages way beyond what the publication can actually tell us. And I found this to be a very useful academic venture, which helps not only us pediatric orthopedists, but even several young trainees to develop a scientific mind, to question literature, to understand the finer nuances of what they're actually reading. Besides this, we have also developed certain fellowships for our younger trainees through POSI. We have now collaborations with centers in Canada and in the UK. Again, thanks to the work of Kishore Bhulpuri and Sanjeev Madan from Sheffield, who have opened up centers in the UK and in Canada, for our younger trainees to specialize in, to do a year of international training, to come back home, to spread that knowledge and information to all of us. So I think that's something that we're really proud of in POSSE, to have created these fellowships. One which has been recently created thanks to a grant which has come in from Dr. Ashok Johari as part of his Silver Jubilee celebration, to create a fund for the rural orthopedic surgeon. And we realized that while in the urban centers of the country, you can still access good healthcare, in very rural areas where 70% of our population lives, most orthopedic surgeons do not have exposure to pediatric orthopedics. And now we've created this rural fellowship where a surgeon from an underserved area can now visit a center of excellence in pediatric orthopedics for a period of around 1 to 3 months and learn basic pediatric orthopedic surgeries. For example, basic trauma, how to deal with infections, septic arthritis, and osteomyelitis in a young child, how to deal with very simple surgeries that are required in children, because we found that many of them treat adults well, but when it comes to children, they are unaware of the right principles and what to do exactly. So that's another thing we're really proud of. We are going to kickstart it. We were supposed to kickstart it last year, but thanks to the COVID pandemic, it has been delayed to this or the next year. But that's some of the offerings that we have from POSSE. And anyone who's interested, we encourage anyone to go onto our website, POSSE.in. We are more than happy to welcome people to attend our annual conferences. We consider ourselves not just as an Indian organization, but as a regional one, because we have members now, not just from India, but from several countries in the Indian subcontinent, including members who have come to us from Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, who have attended our annual conferences over the last 5 or 10 years. And we pride ourselves on being a regional organization now, which deals with problems and helps people understand the spectrum of conditions that they have experienced in their own countries. Unlike when you go abroad and you sometimes see a spectrum that you don't often see, we would rather train someone in the spectrum of conditions that we see here in our Asian subcontinent. So that's some of the ventures that we have undertaken over the last few years in POSSE, and I'm happy for you to have mentioned them.
I mean, and I can recommend to any of our listeners to attend one of the POSSECon meetings. I was very fortunate enough to attend the Silver Jubilee meeting held in Mumbai in 2019. And you know, it was incredible. The speakers had come from around the world. The faculty was amazing. And as you said, they didn't just explain, you know, the types of conditions that are so rare and that you won't see very often, but really dealt with the core conditions, trauma, dealing with infection. And as a fellow, which I was at the time, it was incredible insight to learn from such esteemed colleagues. Finally, I know you're a big reader. And to be fair, with what we have spoken about so far, you are making some real huge changes. These are real moonshot changes. This is not changing a service or a quality improvement project in a hospital. This is changing national screening programs. This is improving surveillance for CP and establishing a national database in a country that has such a huge population. Tell me a one or two books that I can read to be inspired to try and tackle these issues like you have.
Well, thank you for that question. You know, I'm not a very elitist reader. I read whatever comes my way, and I read far and wide, things even beyond my interest. But I think one book that I really got impressed with was Ikigai, which is the Japanese secret, as they say, to a fulfilling career and life. And what it says there is, of course, the author lived in Okinawa, where they had people who lived really long lives and who were very fulfilled at the end of that life. It was just a long life, but leading a fulfilling life. And I think what came out from that book was to say that find something that really drives you. Don't always look for the monetary aspects of it, because, you know, it's very rare to find a job which fulfills, or a career which fulfills all or ticks all of those boxes. But if you find something that really drives you well, something that makes you wake up in the morning and say, I'm really keen on this, use that as your talent, use that as a way to improve the quality of life for yourself and for others around you. And I think in the long run, that really gives you a lot of fulfillment. And that's something that I've really lived by. So that's one thing that I would recommend. Of course, there are scores of other books which have influenced us over the years, both in leadership as well as in what it means by in leaving a legacy. But I think this is one that really influenced me.
Yes, and thankfully I read it, and my memory serves me that it's all about finding something where your passion meets your purpose, but in the service of others, that's what gives you the most fulfillment. So, no, definitely highly recommend that to all of our listeners. Dr. Ruges, thank you so much for the time you have given us today. You are truly a champion in fostering collaboration and improving the real core pathologies that we see in children in such a huge nation like India. As an Indian that's never lived in India, it's been an incredible honor to hear you speak, and it's inspired me so much more to know what changes we can influence in our practice and in our careers going forward. Thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Pranay. I really enjoyed this. Thank you once again for having me. Cheers.